Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we run the technical net for the next approximately 4 hours, as we've done since 1982, so we're going on 35 years worth. Tonight will be technet number 1,682. You'll also be hearing space report number 282. And you'll be hearing physics and science report, which we haven't given numbers to yet, but we got to start giving those numbers. I'll have to go back to the records and find out what number science and physics report we're going to be doing tonight. Let me drop. The TechNet for the last 20 years or so has been divided into three sections. The first section, people sign in because they do have a question or a comment, and we take those in order. And we try to answer those people's questions about radio in general, but can be also non-radio subjects, anything of interest to a radio amateur, which is pretty far and wide, transmission lines and antennas and transmitters and receivers and propagation and the 26 different kinds of ham radio that there are. So those are the typical kinds of questions. That's the first section. The first section averages something like an hour's worth, although there's a whole lot of questions and a lot of enthusiasm. There are times when that has gone on for 2.5 hours. Let me drop. Or there are times where that might be even less than an hour. The second section of the TechNet used to be the mailbag, which was handled in the beginning by HIP and to FDJ, who's now got new call letters of WB2HJK. Then it was handled by Mel, K2KEY, who's now a silent key. And then it also was handled by KC2WGV, John, who is also a silent key. So people who weren't able to sign into the TechNet because they didn't have the right equipment, the right license, or whatever, would, by email, snail mail, bird, pigeon flights, or whatever, would get a message to us about a question they had, and we would handle those in the second section. Let me drop. And we did that for about an hour's worth. Part of the reason for the mailbag is the fact that I have said over and over that as a consulting engineer, I can talk 150 words a minute. I've got a lot of opinions on transmission lines, antennas, transmitters, whatever. I've got a lot of opinions. And since I can talk 150 words a minute, I can give a lot of information in a hurry. I'm a very slow typer. So if people send me a written request, most of the time I cannot answer it. You take, for instance, what Mel, K2KEY, was experiencing when he was handling the mailbag. There were times when he would have 75 letters in 1 week of people asking questions. This is way beyond what I could handle. And so I don't write fast enough. I can talk fast. So everything I do is purely verbal over the TechNet. Both Mel, K2KEY, and John, KC2WGB, did their best to answer people's questions of those emails. And then the significant emails that they got, they would bring them to the net during the second session, and we would discuss them. Let me drop. And in the history of the TechNet, the third section was then, for the last 5.5 years, has been run by Paul, WS2N, giving us the space report, telling us what National Aeronautics and Space Administration and all the other worldwide space agencies, what are they doing? He brings us up to date. So that's the way it has been for quite a number of years. Well, with the passing of Mel, K2KEY, who handled the mailbag, with the passing of John, KC2WGB, who handled the mailbag, and now Roy, AC2GS, has volunteered for that second section, and he said that with that past history of both of them becoming silent keys, he worried a little bit. Let me drop. Dr. Roy, who really is a physician, a licensed physician, practicing licensed physician, has a lot of other talents. So more than just a mailbag answerer, he really has been taking over what we call the science and physics section. And he'll be bringing up an interesting question tonight, I think, on the subject of Doppler shift and some unusual ways of evaluating and recognizing what's going on with the Doppler shift effect with either audio or with radio-like signals. electromagnetic signals. Let me drop. So this is the usual schedule of the TechNet. First hour, questions and answers. Second hour or so, what used to be mailbag and is now science and physics. And the third section, the space report. There's nothing magic about the exact amount of time we allocate to each of those. There's nothing magic about this particular menu and schedule that we follow. If a lot of people express opinions, we're willing to change. In the very beginning, way back in 1982, at the beginning of the TechNet, it was roughly 1 hour long. And after a while, and I thought that 1 hour per week, every single week, I thought we would answer everybody's questions in 6 months and dry up and go away. Here we are 34 and a half years later, and instead of 1 hour, people were complaining that there wasn't enough time to answer all the questions, so it went to 2 hours, then to 3 hours. Now we're up to roughly four. Let me drop. This particular net might be a record as to the longest number of hours on the air for the longest period of time for a network under essentially one leadership. So the total number of hours on the air of the TechNet is greater than the total number of hours that Johnny Carson did in 30 years of running the Tonight Show. Just gives you a little bit of a way of evaluating. I think we're talking about 6,000 hours worth. Let me drop. So, as such, when it comes to sign-in, we're only asking for people to sign in because they do have a question or a comment for the net. We don't need a great big long list of people saying we're listening. After 34 and a half years, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven anymore. Eric, KE2EJ, has made this particular set of radio for this particular repeater group. It now has IRLP and Echo Link. So therefore, we occasionally get check-ins from people in other states and other countries to the TechNet. And we welcome those. Let me drop.
375 up tonight.
Eric is working on 975-375. Right now, it is off the air, or at least it's not connected to this particular repeater right now. And Eric is working on that. So maybe we'll get a repair sometime in the next period of time, it says here. So as I was starting to say, the particular schedule we follow, the menu of what we do during each hour, that's subject to, if a lot of people have a lot of opinion and a good reason for it, we can change that. What we've got right now is what people have requested, so to speak. When it comes to questions for the TechNet, bear in mind, there is no such thing to this group as a so-called dumb question. Our philosophy is that a so-called dumb question represents the biggest difference between what the guy knows and what he would like to know. Therefore, he is most deserving of an answer. We don't have the attitude of, well, that question doesn't come up to our the level of our whatever you're going to call it, classiness. We don't worry about that. So don't worry about asking a dumb question. Don't worry about asking a repeat question. If you asked a question 2 weeks ago and last week and now you started carrying out the suggestions and there's still more that's unsettled, you're allowed to come back and ask it again. So don't worry about that. Let me drop. One of the crazy pieces of information I want to give you guys right now, because we've had so many days of very frigid weather, and a couple of my friends have been calling me with a problem. They're worried about can they keep their furnace running to keep the house warm, that if they lose heat in the house and the house starts getting cold, are they going to freeze the pipes, burst the pipes with ice, and then get water damage in the house? Of course, in weather like this, you're going to try the best you can to make sure your oil tank doesn't run out of oil, your propane tank doesn't run out of propane, and your electric bill is paid. However you heat your house, you're going to do the best you can. If you do your own furnace service like I do, you make sure you have enough spare parts and nozzles and so on to keep everything running. But no matter how much you try and prepare, there are occasions where you're going to lose heat in the house. In a house under these conditions, a typical house has a thermal time constant of something like 10 hours. Every 10 hours, it goes down to two-thirds of the change in temperature between outside and what the inside was to begin with. A typical house has that kind of a thermal time constant. So in a fraction of a day, your house can go down to freezing temperatures, and you got to start worrying about freezing the pipes. It'd be nice to say that we've all got heaters on our pipes, and that can't possibly happen. That's out of the question. particularly since many of those pipes are in the wall. Let me drop them. There's one other last resort solution you should know about. You will not get freezing of the water in the pipes if every one of the faucets in your house is set for a very slow drip. So if you think your house is going to become freezing, in fact, a buddy of mine went to Florida, and he's pretty sure the house is going to stay warm because the furnace is going to keep running. But just in case it fails while he's in Florida, he set each one of his faucets for a very slow drip. So even in the worst case, if the house does go down to freezing temperature, the slow drip of the faucets will mean the water is continuously moving very slowly in the pipes, and under those conditions, it will not freeze. So keep that at the back of your mind as a very good solution to that situation. Okay, at this time, we're going to take check-ins from people who do have a question or a comment. You're going to give me your call letters and your name. Try to remember to give me your name because I'm so darn forgetful. Also, try to remember to wait for the three or four beeps in between each transmission. Let me drop it.
November 2, Zulu Charlie John.
If you know that we're about to approach you, and therefore you're excited to give an answer right away, and you pick up before the beeps occur, there's a chance you're going to get timed out and we won't hear what you're going to say. So do remember to wait for the beeps in between transmissions. So at this time, I'm checking from people who do have a question or a comment for the net.
I'm showing you, Dick.
Okay, the first person who signed in was November Zulu John. You didn't give me your name, but what's the rest of your call letters? November Zulu John, go ahead.
November 2 Zulu Charlie.
You still didn't give me your name. November 2 Zulu Charlie. What is your name, sir?
Name is John.
And I correct myself. Yes, you did say John the first time. Okay, Rich, N2EL, we've got you. So far we've got John and Rich. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now after waiting for the beeps.
Off X-ray Mike, Rich, yes.
W-H. Bravo, November, Freddie, Far Rockaway, yes, yes.
You guys are all talking on top of each other. Let's go back to something to X-ray Mike, Rich. What's the prefix there, X-ray Mike?
Bravo to Golf X-ray Mike. Rich, yes. Thanks, Dick.
Okay, Golf X-ray Mike. Okay. The next one was WA2RYY. Joe, is that correct? Joe, you're signing in?
Yeah, so the reason I wasn't being able to be heard 3 weeks ago is because of the problem with your radio system. Every time I would modulate the squawk, she closed the receiver that was hearing me, and you heard nothing because that was to the tape of the TechNet from 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, you brought that to our attention at that time, and Eric did tell you that he was working on it, or a portion of the system was down. So we weren't selecting you for rejection. The system, the physics of the system. So far we've got check-ins of John, Rich, Rich 1, Rich 2, and Joe. There was another person signing in. Who was that? K2RIW in the TechNet. Give me your call letters and name right now after the beeps.
K2RW, K2 again.
2, VBN, Freddy.
I got Eric.
I got Eric.
And something 2VBN. Freddie, on a number of occasions you've checked in, and when we got around to going to you, you were no longer there. You're going to be going away real early again tonight. Freddie, go ahead.
I'll stay awake.
Okay, Eric, are you giving us a point of order? Is that why you checked in? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Yeah, hello, 1-2. Dick, I don't know if you can hear me. Yeah, it looks like you can. Yeah, hello, this isn't working.
I'm hearing you beautifully.
Okay. EchoLink is now up and running, so people can deal with that. Actually, there's a K1XRM that just logged in. I gotta go back down to the car and get some stuff, but I'm going to disconnect the antenna for a moment while I put my power meter in line, so stand by.
Okay, we'll be standing by. There's only 50 pieces of electronics you're keeping running all at once, KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. You know, I'm confused because I can't hear myself talking, that's all. Investigating a couple things. I don't know what's going on with 375, it should just work. I don't even know if it's working locally, so. We'll see. Actually, what I'm getting, we're sending about 40 watts to the antenna after everything else.
So I think you're estimating by way of your bird watt meter at the transmitter, and then you insert the insertion loss of the cable between there and the antenna. I think you're saying you're putting 40 watts to the antenna, which for a repeater at that location, that many feet above sea level, and a good station master antenna, that's a significant effective isotropic radiated power. And good luck on feeding and fixing up 975-375, the other repeater connected to this network, which I guess is 20 miles away out in Selden. Sure, it'd be nice if it's only the link that needs repair right where you are, but I guess there's a chance you might have to drive the 20 miles. KE2EJ for any other comments, K2RIW.
Yeah, I might, I gotta go down to the car and get my computer and a couple of other things. But first, let me get the IRLP running, which I can do here. And what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna hook the power sensor, the repeater, up to a data channel that I have so I can monitor it. Because right now, the thing's rock solid. So I guess we'll see where it goes. K2RIW, K2J.
With the testing you're doing right now, Eric, in the next half hour or so, will there be a time when you also want us to interrupt so you can do a test? You think, do you anticipate that?
Yeah, I'm going to interrupt you at some point, but not just yet.
Okay, we'll be waiting for that. For the last 2 weeks, because of the holidays, the TechNet hasn't existed. We're now back after a two-week hiatus. I think that's the right word for it. Next week, there's a chance that there will not be a TechNet next week. There's a group of people who I've been a member of for the last 12 years, and they're having their very late Christmas party next Sunday. So most likely I'll be attending that, unless someone else wants to volunteer to do the TechNet in my absence. I think there will not be one next week. Considering the total number of hours that the TechNet has existed, as I said, something like 6,000 hours worth, I think everybody's getting their money's worth. It says here, the price is right. We don't guarantee 100% accuracy, but at least it is peer-reviewed material. Let me drop. If you go to the website of amateurradio.tangovictor, www.amateurradio.tangovictor, you'll see the website of Mike Perry, KC2NJI, who for the last 10 or 11 years has been recording the last 11 years worth of the 34 years of TechNet, and they're on that website. Choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and you can play back everything that took place on the TechNet. By way of that website, people review our material. Some people, you know, can't stay up that late, but they make a recording of it and play it on their tape recorder while they're on the train to work or whatever. And if we make errors, people find those errors, bring it to our attention, and we make the correction. Nobody bats 1,000. No matter how hard you try, you're never going to have 100% accuracy of giving people technical information, particularly on the complicated subjects of radio and antennas and propagation. Another website, that's Mike number one. Mike number two's website is K1MJM's website, which is at LimarkTechNet.com, which also contains additional information, photographs, articles, and whatever, of what goes on with the TechNet. Okay. I think I've told you about why we were away for 2 weeks, why we might not be here next week, how to keep your pipes freezing, and it's time to go to the question and answer period. Now, my writing is so sloppy, I'm not sure John, the first guy who checked in, I think it's November 2, Zulu Charlie. I may have that wrong, or Golf Zulu Charlie. You've got it, John. K2RIW, TechNet, my mark. My name is Dick. You've got the floor, John.
Thank you very much, Dick. This is my first time on the TechNet, and I don't think it'll be the last. I was at Ham Radio University, and we got into a very interesting conversation, and two gentlemen I met there recommended I come here and put forth this question to you, that you may be able to answer it and shed some light on it. And what my question was is that many years ago I had seen a demonstration where gentlemen used three tuning forks. Two were at his side, one on the other side of the room. Three in total, two with him, one of the tuning forks, one of the three on the other side of the room. He struck one of the tuning forks and it vibrated, gave an audible tone. And then he struck the other one and it gave an audible tone. And you heard them. He put his hand over one of them and grabbed it, which stopped it from vibrating, and that tone stopped. When he grabbed the second one, the tone continued, and you know, the demonstration was that the tuning fork on the other side of the room, because it was resonant, picked up the vibration, and it was giving the audible tone off there. And I'm just going to drop. I don't know how long I have on the repeater, and I'll come right back. Okay, and I had, from that point on, put it in my mind that that was a very good demonstration, that the mechanical sound waves were disturbing the air and transmitting this through the air to the other side of the room, causing that tuning fork at that frequency to vibrate, sort of a transmitter and receiver. And I was very comfortable extrapolating that onto dipole antennas. And right or wrong, I kind of sat with that and understanding the frequency wavelength of the dipole and the two ends, etc. What my question is that this whole demonstration, this theory that I sat with all these years, sort of falls apart when we talk about verticals. With a vertical antenna, I hear many explanations, but I can never actually visualize or be comfortable with the explanations I get for myself, that I fully understand it. And the reason is, we have the one radiator that is vertical, and then I am told we have other legs that come out, and we use terms such as counterpoise, mirror, ground, and it's needed for the efficiency. And okay, where I get lost is there doesn't seem to be any resonant requirements of the other leg, of the actual vertical part of the antenna yet, but on the horizontal ground plane, no. And can you shed some light onto this?
Okay, we heard everything you said, John, right up to the end of your question. A very perceptive question, by the way. And then the machine went into a standby mode of some kind. It just came back. Darn good question. Let me show you why. One of the things that I've said very frequently, and many people have heard it, maybe they're tired of hearing it, you being on the TechNet for the first time, you're going to hear it for the first time. If you are an antenna designer or an antenna builder and you want the antenna to work well, and work well in the usual ham radio vocabulary, means that of the power you put into the antenna, you'd like 95% of it to be radiated into space. That kind of efficiency is what we're talking about. So when it comes to antennas of that kind of efficiency, the seven most important words in your language is you resonate first, then it will radiate. In the old days, we used to force the length of the dipole to be exactly a half wavelength electronically so that it would resonate and radiate well. If you made it too long or too short, you end up with a very high standing wave ratio and much lower efficiency. Let me drop. Nowadays, many of us are using automatic antenna tuners, which even if the antenna was too short or too long, the automatic antenna tuner adds whatever inductance or capacitance is required and forces it back into resonance. So a real antenna is resonant. And there's a whole lot of stories about what goes on there, and I won't go into that right now. So a half-wave dipole is a resonant structure. The signal is bouncing back and forth, left side, right side, and so on. The amount of circulating energy in the dipole is about 10 times higher than the energy that you're feeding into it. You're pouring 10 watts into that dipole. The energy bouncing back and forth is around 100 watts after you've gone through the rise time, which is some number of microseconds. Let me drop. While that resonating dipole is half-wave dipole is doing its thing, at one instant of time, the right-hand side is positive, the left-hand side is negative. You could put a sheet of metal right down the middle of the dipole at right angle to the wire. And because it's in the neutral plane, the right side is positive, the left side is negative, the sheet of metal is in the neutral plane. If the sheet of metal goes to infinity, you put the sheet of metal there, nothing changes. No change to the impedance, no change to the antenna pattern, no change to the radiation efficiency. That sheet of metal is in the neutral plane. It's not doing anything. Once you realize that that sheet of metal is there, and it's acting as a mirror, a reflector, you can throw away the left-hand side of the dipole and just use the right-hand side and the sheet of metal. Take that whole structure and rotate it 90 degrees, and we call it a vertical ground plane antenna with an infinite sheet of metal. Now, the next step in the process is to say, gee, I don't really need a great big sheet of metal that goes to infinity. I can put three or four ground plane radials there, and it'll be a poor man's equivalent of that sheet of metal. Let me drop. So that half-wave dipole, which became a quarter-wave ground plane radiator, is a resonant structure. You can prove that to yourself by taking your antenna tuner, your antenna analyzer, your antenna analyzer, and measuring what is the impedance of the antenna at the operating frequency. You may find out it's 50 ohms. And if you go up in frequency, you'll find out it starts becoming inductive. If you go down in frequency, it starts becoming capacitive. That proves to you it really is resonant at the frequency you're using at, even though it's only a quarter wave. That quarter wave is resonating against that infinite sheet of metal it thinks it sees, which really is your three or four ground plane radials. The ground plane radials acting like the sheet of metal, we give it a whole lot of words. The ground plane, the counterpoise. The signal is really bouncing back and forth between the radiating quarter wave thing and those ground plane radiating rods. As I said, the poor man's equivalent of a sheet of metal. Let me drop. Once the antenna is resonant and doesn't require an antenna tuner to bring it into resonance, as I said, it's got a certain rise time. There's various ways you can run a test by putting a series of brief pulses in there with a very fast oscilloscope. You'd measure the fact that it takes 10 cycles or so at the RF frequency for the radiating antenna to come up to full amplitude. Or when you abruptly stop the transmitting signal and you look at the ring down of the antenna, it'll ring down for at least 10 cycles. It's got a Q of 10. A half-wave dipole under normal methods of construction, or a quarter-wave ground plane under normal methods of construction, has a Q of 10. The word Q really means that it's got five different meanings, but they all mean the exact same thing. The center frequency divided by the bandwidth will come up with 10. That's a Q of 10. Current rise at resonance. It's got 10 times more current flowing in the radiating structure than your transmission line is putting into it. Voltage rise at resonance. It's got a 10 to 1 voltage rise. Energy stored per cycle versus energy dissipated per cycle. Rise time, voltage rise, current rise, there's five different criteria. It sounds like five different tests, five different criteria. It really is the exact same phenomena. You're proving that it's a resonant structure, like a ringing bell, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. So, this is some of the information I think you're looking for, John. I probably have gone a little bit off to one side of your real question. You're allowed to reword it to make sure you're starting to get this concept of what I'm telling you about. By the way, this concept I'm telling you about, that the antenna, the energy your transmission line puts into the antenna, after a certain number of cycles, it brings it up to full amplitude. And, there's where I was going now. The resonance phenomena has got some very peculiar characteristics. Let me drop it. The transmission line that goes between your transmitter and that antenna pumps energy into that antenna, and after about 10 cycles, the energy in the antenna comes up to full voltage and current amplitude. And your transmission line's got a fairly low insertion loss. So your transmitter is putting out 10 watts and 9.5 watts is getting to the antenna. It's got a reasonable transmission line. The space between that tuning fork in the front of the room and the space between this and the tuning fork in the back of the room is a transmission line. That transmission line in that room probably has 20 decibels of loss. In other words, the energy getting to the tuning fork in the back of the room is only 1% of the energy coming from the tuning forks in the front of the room. Let me drop. But the magic of sympathetic resonance, whenever you've got a resonant structure with any kind of a coupling coefficient, whether it be a 20 or 30 dB loss transmission line, like the air in the room, or a real transmission line, like a good piece of coax cable, whenever you've got some kind of a transmission line between two objects, one of which has got some energy, and the other has resonance, which means it has a sympathetic resonance capability of absorbing some of that energy, and after a period of time coming up to full amplitude that it's capable of, the tuning fork in the back of the room. So there's lots of situations like this. You could have a situation where two people on two swings, side by side on a double swing, one guy is never being pushed, and the other guy is being pushed, and he's got full swing. You're pushing your child on swing number one, and swing number two, nobody is pushing him. But if he happens to have the exact same weight, so that he has the exact same period, because there's a little bit of deflection of that horizontal bar on the top of the swing, eventually the guy on the unpushed guy is going to start swinging a little bit. Sympathetic resonance does that. Your grid dip meter measures that characteristic, if you know what I mean. Whenever you've got two structures that have similar resonant frequency with any kind of a coupling coefficient between them, some of the energy from one will go to the other, whether you want it to or not. You can't stop that from happening. N2 Lima Charlie, and I might be missing a letter. Correct me on that, John. K2RIW and TechNet. My name is Dick. You got the beep, John. You don't have to wait for the machine to drop.
Okay, Dick. Thank you very much for that very detailed answer there. And I found your explanation with the plate in the middle very interesting. And I'm going to have to really digest this and picture it just come to terms with it. And I'm sure I'll be back with another question. Let me ask you one last question on this, and I'll let it go with that. When we see the transmission pattern for the dipole, we see two lobes, one coming off one side of the dipole and one coming off the other, and they're symmetric. From your explanation, am I almost to interpret that when we go with the vertical, we're only getting the one lobe, basically? Is that what we're doing? November 2, Zulu Charlie?
What you expressed, John, is good common sense. In this particular case, common sense is leading you astray. A full half-wave dipole radiates broadside. If the wire of your dipole goes east-west, the strongest signal coming out of the dipole is north and south, broadside. That's the pattern you see when you have a simple dipole above the ground and you're looking at the azimuthal pattern. If you look at the full three-dimensional pattern, if you had your dipole in free space and you took a picture of the full three-dimensional pattern of the dipole, it looks like a huge donut, a toroid, a torus, with the wire going down the hole of the dipole, down the hole of the donut. It radiates broadside to the wire, and it radiates broadside on, if the dipole was a vertical dipole, then it would radiate equal amount of energy around the whole compass, north, south, east, west, if you know what I mean. So it radiates broadside. When you put the sheet of metal there, Remember I told you put the sheet of metal? It's a neutral plane. The pattern doesn't change. It has the exact same donut pattern, broadside to the wire. When you throw away half of the dipole, because you're now using it as a quarter wave ground plane antenna against that sheet of metal, the pattern doesn't change. It's still broadside. It still has the exact same pattern. If it really was an infinite sheet of metal, yes, there would be no signal in the lower hemisphere, because the sheet of metal would act like a shield. But with your simple ground plane radials, the three or four little stubs coming out of the bottom, it's not much of a shield, and therefore you still have the full pattern broadside to the radiating wire. So that vertical ground plane antenna, vertical
repeater, timeout.
Vertically polarized, has that same full donut pattern, radiating broadside, full compass coverage, north, east, south, west, and so on, northwest, southeast, and all of those compass headings are being covered. And it's hard to believe that what's going on here is that you only have half the dipole left. The other half is there as a mirror image in the sheet of metal. The electrons think that there's another half of the dipole there. It's really the sheet of metal, and the sheet of metal is the poor man's equivalent with those three ground plane radials, or four of them coming out of the bottom, which is good enough to make it a good antenna. And that structure, even though you think you've cheated on the materials, still has capability of being 98% efficient. You put 100 watts into it, 98 watts is being radiated into space into that broadside donut pattern. Over to you, John. November 2, Zulu, Charlie, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, if we take the dipole and, just for argument's sake, we split it in the middle and we call one half positive and one half negative, which I believe at an instantaneous millisecond it would be, the donut is appearing on both sides or throughout the dipole. And there's a donut on the left side, let's say, and then the right side, if we're looking at the center. Again, my intuition is that you've almost cut out half the power, but that's not true. It seems that if this thing is made correctly, that power that was in the... Let's say we have the horizontal dipole and we flip it vertically, okay? And now we're removing the lower section of it. That donut that was around the lower section, the power that was in that donut, is that always there simultaneously on the up and the bottom, or does it vacillate between the top and the bottom?
82FIU, quick comment.
John, once again, you're using good common sense. But again, common sense in this case will lead you astray. A ordinary dipole with normal construction techniques has a Q of 10. That means that your transmission line might be a 50-ohm transmission line. You're running 50 watts into it, which means that it's running 50 volts at 1 ampere on the transmission line. 50 watts, 50-ohm transmission line. You go through mathematics, you'll find out it's 50 volts RMS and 1 ampere. So your transmission line, in my example, with 50 watts, is pumping 1 ampere into your full half-wave dipole. The dipole has a Q of 10. Once the resonance comes up 10 cycles later, there is 10 amperes flowing back between the left side and the right side of that dipole.
Repeater, timeout.
Once it's in full operation, there's 10 amperes flowing, even though your transmission line is only supplying 1 ampere. That's a hard one to believe. Take my word for it. The 10 amperes between the left side and the right side, the energy is bouncing back and forth between the two sides, and it's at 432 megacycles, at 146 megacycles, 146 million times per second, the energy is bouncing back and forth between the two sides. 10 amperes of current is flowing in the center. That current makes a very strong magnetic field. Arguably, the magnetic field is the first thing that starts the radiation. You analyze any of the antenna modeling programs, you'll find out they go through a whole bunch of fancy calculations to calculate how much current is flowing into each 16th of an inch of the wire of the dipole, and then what does that do to the overall antenna pattern. It's measuring current, the antenna modeling programs, and calculates that into a magnetic field How strong is the magnetic field? How strong is the signal that's being radiated? When you throw away the left half of the dipole and put in the ground plane sheet instead, the exact same amount of current flows at the bottom of that, the intersection between the radiator and the ground plane. The exact same 10 amperes is flowing. The exact same magnetic field is flowing. The exact same pattern is flowing. Remember, let me drop. Remember when I told you you put the sheet of metal there? It does not change the impedance, does not change the antenna pattern, does not change the efficiency. Everything stays the same. Yes, if you really did it with an infinite sheet of metal, the bottom hemisphere wouldn't be there because the sheet of metal would be a shield. When you do it with the poor man's sheet of metal, the radials, it is just the other half of the dipole. The other half of the dipole is now in those three radials. They just happen to be a quarter wavelength long. Because they're at right angles, it confuses you. The other half of the dipole is there. It's now this funny ground plane structure. The current in the center is the same. The radiated signal is the same. And if you compared the gain and antenna pattern of a quarter wave ground plane antenna held up in space versus a full half wave dipole, you would have great difficulty saying which antenna pattern is which. They look almost the same. I know that's opposite of common sense, but when you go through the mathematics of where the current is, where the magnetic field is, that full pattern is still there. And so you, the portion of your donut pattern that was above the sheet of metal and below the sheet of metal, it is there with your method of constructing that quarter wave ground plane. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
82FIU, quick comment.
John first. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, go ahead. Quick comment.
You got it, George.
Thank you, Dick. Picture it like this, John. You've taken your dipole and you folded one leg in the air. Your impedance has dropped probably to around 40 ohms. You could tune it. You could resonate it by adjusting the length or the horizontal leg of that dipole. You will have directionality because you've folded one leg vertically. You still have each pole of energy resonating equally.
I like what George is saying, and I'm going to go one step further with what George is saying. The left-hand side of the dipole, I take a very, let's assume now I made it out of something that is conductive and 1 inch in diameter. My whole dipole is 1 inch in diameter out of some kind of materials. And now I take a very sharp razor blade and cut the left-hand side lengthwise with three separate cuts. So I've now split the left-hand side with three cuts, and each one of those cut pieces, I bend it at 90 degrees from where it used to be, so it's now at right angles to the right-hand side, and those three cuts that I just made are the three ground plane radials. I've got the exact same electrical length. I've just changed the mechanical layout by going by what George is saying and going the next step. Is that giving you a little bit more comfortable feel for what is a quarter-wave ground plane antenna, John? N2ZZ-Charlie, K2LAW.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is, Dick. It is. Do those ground planes then, is there significance in the, like the CB days, when I started and many of us did as a CB operator, and you know, the ground plane antenna, which worked beautifully, and it had three radials at about a 45-degree angle. Were those, the length of those then, were they in any way corresponding to the frequency, the resonant frequency of the vertical element? And to Sulu Charlie?
Absolutely. Your main radiator is electronically a quarter wavelength long. Each of your ground plane radials is a quarter wavelength long for two reasons. One, you could say they were made by taking the left-hand side and splitting it into three strips and then bending them at right angles. You could say it that way. They started off as a quarter wavelength long. They ended up as a quarter wavelength long. There's another thing going on here. The base of the antenna If it really was an infinite sheet of metal, the base of the antenna would be at 0 volts, and the radiator itself at the base is where you're launching, in my example, the 50 volts into it at 50 watts. And the dipole used to have 73 ohms impedance. If you then put that sheet of metal there, half the antenna is gone, the 70 ohms becomes 35 ohms. 72 ohms becomes 36. A dipole, a quarter wave ground plane antenna with an infinite sheet of metal would be a 36 ohm antenna. When you take those radials and bend them down a little bit, maybe at a 45 degree angle, you come up closer to 50 ohms, and still it's resonant. But the original 10 amperes of current from resonance flowing in the center of the full half-wave dipole, you have the exact same 10 amperes of current flowing into the base of that quarter-wave ground plane. It's got the same magnetic field, same radiated pattern, same efficiency, same, except for a slight change in the impedance, which you can affect, you can adjust by adjusting those ground plane radials. You're getting the impression now how magic this quarter-wave ground plane antenna really is. Back to you, John, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, you've been very generous with me, and I appreciate it. Thank you also the other gentleman that chimed in with that. I'm going to let it go with this. I'm going to digest what you told me. I have a lot to think about. You explained it terrifically. I can visualize it. It makes sense. I do suspect I'll be back with one or two questions, but I don't want to hog anything right now. So, gentlemen, thank you so much. And November 2, Zulu Charlie, I'll be on the side here listening and enjoyed all of it.
Yeah, welcome aboard, John. After 34 years, I'm kind of glad you discovered the technical net. And I'm not saying that to be derogatory. There's a hell of a lot of people who lived a normal life and never heard about the tech net, even though it's been around 4 hours every single week, 52 times per year for 34 years. And, you know, just a coincidence of people not running into it. All of the information you have just heard, John, 90% of it is not in a course that you can take at a respected college in RF electrical engineering. An awful lot of it is not in the books that you can read. I've often said that if you really want somebody who understands radio equipment, you've got to hire a ham radio operator. They're the people who touch it, feel it, got passion for it, work with it, pass information back and forth between their friends on the air. And so the books don't have the information. The classes don't have the information. It's groups like this who get together where we pass information back and forth. You now know a number of the inner secrets. Antennas are nowhere near as much of a black magic subject as you would think they are. The average electrical engineer, let me drop it. The average electrical engineer specializing in radio electronics, wireless electronics, with a bachelor degree from a respected college. He walks out of that college not knowing what an antenna is, has a very uncomfortable feeling about what is an antenna because of the way it's taught in the school. They set that curriculum in 1947 after the Radlab series of books were written after World War II, and they haven't changed it very much since. There's really time for a change because what they're giving our students is not useful engineering information. Strongly felt opinion. I've been through that process for lots of years, and they ain't doing it right, and they're afraid to change it. The average professor teaching the subject doesn't understand it enough to affect a change, therefore he keeps teaching it the exact same way everyone else did over and over again. Next person on our list was Rich, N2EO. And I guess we're going to start speeding up a little bit because I've spelled... Well, we made an investment with John because that is a very general subject. A hell of a lot of people, just like John, don't feel comfortable about how does that ground plane antenna really work. And hopefully we've illuminated some of that tonight. N2EO, K2IW. Go ahead, Rich. Okay, maybe Rich is not there. We'll go to the next Rich and then come back to him. WB2GXM, K2LIW. Go ahead, Rich, number two.
K2LIW in the group, WB2GXM. Thank you, Dick. This is Rich, wishing everybody a happy new year. I have a quick question. I'm still using an HT to access W2VL from the city line at Floral Park. After midnight, all I get is occasional breaks in a squelch with no voice, which I expect. I'm also getting that behavior before 8 p.m. and during the day on weekdays. Is the repeater at lower power or off before the TechNet and on weekdays? WB2GXM.
Yeah, I think what you're describing right now, Rich number two, is part of a situation that Eric, KE2EJ, our technical maven that maintains all this equipment, that's what he's investigating right now. The report that Eric has received from the B2CDO, Andy, was that when the repeater has been off for a long time and it's cooled off, and it first comes on the air, Andy's single strength meter on his receiver tells him that the repeater is putting out a small fraction of normal power for the first few minutes until it's been on the air continuously and it heats up, and then it jumps up to full power. So if the repeater has been running for a long time, like right now, you've got full power. If it turns off for, let me pick a number, half an hour, cools off, and you just key it with your handy-talkie or any other transmitter, it comes on with a very low power output for the first couple of minutes until it heats up, and then it jumps into the high power. That's the condition that Andy has recognized. He communicated that to Eric, and Eric is repeating, is investigating it as we speak. That's what I think you have just run into, Rich. Does V2GXM? Good question. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Just to repeat, this behavior has been going on for a couple of years already. WB2GXM.
And Andy's measurements seem to suggest that. Because it is so subtle, you only see this effect if somebody is in a marginal area, like using a handy-talkie at more than 5 miles from the repeater, so to speak. If you're in a marginal area where whether or not it runs full power is something really critical to you, and if it only happens when the machine has been off for a long period of time and somebody keys it up, whereas during normal operation during the day, when the machine is running nearly continuously and it's hot, and it's always running full power, you don't see the effect. You see how subtle it is. That's a guess as to what I think is going on, Rich. The V2GXM, K2RIW TechNet, and it could very well, because it's so subtle, it could have been doing this for years.
Always thankful for your help and for your advice and for your company. Again, to all, Happy New Year, and thanks again. WB2GXM, clear.
Okay, once again, N2EO, if you're there, Rich, K2LIW. Now we'll go over to Joe, W2LYY. Go easy with us tonight, Joe, because sometimes you ask some pretty tough questions. W2LYY, K2LIW in the TechNet. You got it, Joe.
If this mode of operation is working, I can't transmit on my regular radio, so maybe something will be on 9 o'clock. And by the way, Eric, your IRLP is putting out carrier on the IRLP network on 9126. There's no transfer audio coming out. It's one way, going in but not coming out.
Joe, you're giving us a nice, quiet carrier, dead cool quieting, and your audio is good. Your audio is 12 dB lower than normal. I'm hearing you because I'm wearing earphones. Some people are not going to hear you. I heard every one of your words. Anything you can do to creep the increase the audio would be helpful. Do you have a question for us tonight, or is your main message just to Andy, to Eric? W2LYY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I do have a question. The problem is not with my equipment. The equipment is what you're using here. I can hear myself through the repeater. It is very, very low in audio. I cannot transmit on a radio transmitter from my house after 9 o'clock. That's why I'm using IRLP. My HD. My question is, when you looked at the pictures, a couple of pictures I sent you about 3 or 4 weeks ago, one picture you made a comment of, you thought it was a picture of an amplifier. It was not. My question is related to that picture.
Go ahead with your question related to that picture.
Okay, the question related to that picture. You're seeing a transmitter. An old, very old style transmitter, GE transmitter called the Master Pro. On one side, there's two coils, which are part of a overactive tripler. On one side of the TA cage, which houses an 8072 type tube. On the other side of the PA cage is a pair of tuning coils, I guess you'd call them like helical resonators. Those go between the PA cage and the output antenna connector. My question is, why is one of them dark in color and the other one looks like shiny metal like snow? What happened to it?
I have no way of knowing that one, Joe. The darker color sounds like it's got a lot of copper oxide. Maybe one of them is silver plated. Maybe there were different times of manufacture. Maybe one was handled a lot more. So a darker color of a copper coil suggests a lot of copper oxide, like it's been exposed to the air a lot longer. Maybe one of them sat on the shelf a long period of time before that component was put into the amplifier as it's being manufactured, and the other one is brand new. That's a pure guess. I have no way of knowing. If you're asking me, is the current flowing through that coil making it run so hot that it becomes discolored? Is that likely at the power levels you're talking about? I kind of doubt that. But I guess there is a slim possibility that's what's going on, that it's running hotter. A coil that runs hotter will develop copper oxide a lot faster and develop a darker color sooner. Similar to you and I start off with a nice, let me drop. You start off with a nice brand new piece of double-sided copper clad printed circuit board, and maybe there's a plastic covering on one side when it's brand new, and you peel off the copper coloring and you solder down your components and it looks beautiful today, and you come back a year later and look at that PC board and you see great big nasty fingerprints where you touched it, because it oxidized a lot faster there. But in general, the board, if some kind of weatherproofing hasn't been put on it, anything with bare copper exposed to the air is going to develop copper oxide and start becoming darker. To B2RYY, I know you didn't get the answer, because I don't really know. T2RYW.
Well, if you don't know, you don't know. The question was just posted on here just to see if you had an idea, possibly. If you said something that makes sense, possibly the RF current is, on one of those coils is making the thing discolored, but I'm kind of curious. We have different current, and if that's what's doing it between one coil to another, because they are what's called, like, they're tuned with a brass screw that comes off the top of those coils that actually goes through them, so it resembles a helical type of resonator, and the brass screw is part of a, I guess you'd call it the top capacitor that tunes that coil. One side goes to ground, half a turn up is tapped on each of the coils, one tap goes to the antenna jack, the other tap comes from a tuning, comes from an RF pickup inside the PA cage itself, which one side's the ground and one side goes to the tap from that first coil, the one that's discolored. And I did think what you said, that possibly it's discolored because of high RF current, but I'm just kind of curious why one has high RF current that's making it possibly discolored, and the other one should carry the same current out because it's going to a 50 ohm impedance, and the other one's not discolored. Back to you.
You did say, Eric, that this is a frequency tripler assembly. And whenever you've got the parasitic resonators in a tripler assembly that you're trying to, by some kind of diode-like action, you're generating a third harmonic frequency from the fundamental being generated probably by the 8072 tube. Whenever you've got those kind of resonators doing tripling, there's nothing to say that the current on each of those coils is going to be identical depending on the design of that circuit. Back to you, Joe.
The tripling is done by the rocket tripler, which feeds the 8072 because it has one tube before that, an 8156 compact one tube, runs at about 150 megahertz, and that excites the diodes, the rocket diodes. In that assembly, one coil is tuned to 150 megahertz, the other one is tuned to 450 megahertz. That feeds the grid assembly, the 8072. The 8072 is operating completely in the 450 band. It's not tripling frequency by itself.
Okay, you just said some magic. One of those coils is operating at 150 megs, the other one's operating at 450 megs. And so, under those conditions, there's nothing to say that both of them have the exact same amount of current flowing through them, Joe. Go ahead.
I'm not talking about the output coils, the two output coils on the other side of the PA cage. I'm talking about the input coils that are on the right in the bracket tripler assembly stage. That's also called a node. They also resemble a helical resonator with coils. In those cases, they're open, just like the other ones are open at one end, top end. And they use the brass tuning screw that comes from the top of the assembly when the assembly cover is on the PA cage.